So I started really thinking about this, and I realized I didn't want to write a book about can they or can't they. I wanted to write a book about why is it that some of us listen and some of us don't? Why is it that some of us can listen and some of us can't? And then the book sort of blew open for me when I realized I really wanted to write about the ways that, I really wanted to write about the fact that before you can exploit somebody, you have to silence them. At which point my agent, former agent, was getting really sketch. I'd like to read the first few pages of this book now. There's a language older by far and deeper than words. It's the language of bodies, of body on body, wind on snow, rain on trees, wave on stone. It's the language of dream, gesture, symbol, memory. We've forgotten this language. We don't even remember that it exists. In order for us to maintain our way of living, we must tell lies to each other, and especially to ourselves. It's not necessary that the lies be particularly believable. The lies act as barriers to truth. And I don't know how it is for any of you, but whenever I write something, the first sentence is really about half the work. Once I get the first sentence, the whole rest of the book or essay or whatever it is just reeling it in. And this book really has two first sentences. There's a language older by far and deeper than words. So a lot of the book is about what is that language of our body? What does it feel like to be in your body? What does it smell like? What does it taste like? What is the experience of living in a world if you're in your body in this world? And the other half of the book is about, in order to maintain our way of living, we must tell lies to each other, especially to ourselves. And it's about the lies we tell ourselves and each other in order to stay away from our bodies, in order to keep ourselves out of our bodies. Why do we do that? What are the advantages? What are the disadvantages? How does that happen? What are the consequences? Anyway, the lies act as barriers to truth. These barriers to truth are necessary because without them, many deplorable acts would become impossibilities. Truth must at all costs be avoided. When we do allow self-evident truths to percolate past our defenses and into our consciousness, they're treated like so many hand grenades rolling across the dance floor of an improbably macabre party. We try to stay out of harm's way, afraid they'll go off, shatter our delusions, and leave us exposed to what we've done to the world and to ourselves, exposed as the hollow people we've become. And so we avoid these truths, these self-evident truths, and continue the dance of world destruction. As is true for most children, when I was young, I heard the world speak. Stars sang, stones had preferences, trees had bad days, toads held lively discussions, crowed over a good day's catch. Like static on a radio, schooling and other forms of socialization began to interfere with my perception of the animate world. And for a number of years, I almost believed that only humans spoke. The gap between what I experienced and what I almost believed confused me deeply. It wasn't until later that I began to understand the personal, political, social, ecological, and economic implications of living in a silenced world. This silencing is central to the workings of our culture. The staunch refusal to hear the voices of those we exploit is crucial to our domination of them. Religion, science, philosophy, politics, education, psychology, medicine, literature, linguistics, art have all been pressed into service as tools to rationalize the silencing and degradation of women, children, other races, other cultures, the natural world and its members, our emotions, our consciences, our experiences, our cultural and personal histories. My own introduction to this silencing, and this is similarly true for a great percentage of children as well within many families, came at the hands and genitals of my father, who beat my mother, my brothers, and my sisters, and who raped my mother, my sister, and me. I can only speculate that because I was the youngest, my father somehow thought it best that instead of beating me, he would force me to watch and listen. I remember scenes vaguely as from a dream or a movie, my father chasing my brother Rob around and around the house. I remember my mother pulling my father into their bedroom to absorb blows that may have otherwise landed on her children. We sat stone-faced in the kitchen, captive audience to stifled groans that escaped through walls that were just too thin. The vagueness with which I recollect these formative images is the point here. Because the worst thing my father did went beyond the hitting and the raping to the denial that any of it ever occurred. Not only bodies were broken, but broken also was the bedrock connection between memory and experience, between psyche and reality. His denial made sense, not only because an admission of violence would have harmed his image as a socially respected, wealthy, and deeply religious attorney, but more simply because the man who'd beat his children couldn't speak about it honestly and continue to do it. And of course, any culture that would kill the salmon, you know, can't speak about it honestly. Any culture that would eradicate the prairie dogs. If we could talk about it, maybe we wouldn't do it. We became a family of amnesiacs. There's no place in the mind to sufficiently contain these experiences, and as there was effectively no way out, it would have served no purpose for us to consciously remember the atrocities. So we learned day after day that we couldn't trust our perceptions, and that we were better off not listening to our emotions. Daily we forgot, and if a memory pushed its way to the surface, we forgot again. There'd be a beating, followed by brief contrition, my father asking, "Why did you make me do it?" And then, nothing, save the inconvenient evidence, a broken door, urine-soaked underwear, a wooden room divider my brother repeatedly tore from the wall trying to pick up speed around the corner. Once these were fixed, there was nothing left to remember. So we forgot, and the pattern continued. So what else do we forget? Do we think about nuclear devastation, or the wisdom of producing tons of plutonium, which is lethal even in microscopic doses for well over 250,000 years? Does global warming invade our dreams? In our most serious moments, do we consider that industrial civilization has initiated the greatest mass extinction in the history of the planet? How often do we consider that our culture commits genocide against every indigenous culture it encounters? As we consume the products manufactured by our culture, are we concerned about the atrocities that make them possible? How do you live in this fucking city? You know? I was in New York in February, and snow was falling, and I kept thinking that all these snowflakes are going, "No, please, not there." We don't stop these atrocities because we don't talk about them. We don't talk about them because we don't think about them. We don't think about them because they're too horrific to comprehend. As trauma expert Judith Herman writes, the ordinary response to atrocities is to banish them from consciousness. Certain violations of the social compact are too terrible to utter aloud. This is the meaning of the word unspeakable. As the ecological fabric of the natural world unravels around us, perhaps it's time that we begin to speak of the unspeakable and to listen to that which we've deemed unhearable. A grenade rolls across the floor. Look, it won't go away.